broadcasting from the shores of El Pacifico. Bill Hendry.
And look at how this bill was written. Can you say it was done openly?
I did believe, and still believe, that Senate bill...
It is familiar with what's going on today. You can walk into the National World War II Museum.
You said you've made transgressions. How would you, in your own words...
That's just stuck on stupid.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show, every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast. The News Talk and Entertainment Show that other talk show hosts listen to. The News Talk and Entertainment Show where truth is our bitch. The News Talk and Entertainment, you know, all of that cool stuff. The health care bill has passed, and tonight some angry fanatics are making death threats on Twitter over it. You may live in the riskiest city for cybercrime. We'll tell you which ones those are. And we have senior military advisor to HBO's The Pacific, Captain Dale Dye, joining us live here in a few minutes to talk about the Pacific. We also have Vernon Dozier and Lloyd Bonafide. Tonight on our show, we have the man, and we've discovered the man who has admitted to us, and we will have him on the air, who used the N-word on John Lewis on the steps of the Capitol there in Washington. They've been trying to find this tape. They've been looking for the guy. Where is he? Who is he? Why is he? Well, we've got it tonight on the show. Our affiliate spotlight this evening, Houston, KPRC 950 AM, and in Mobile, Alabama, WAVH 106.5 FM. We are very proud to be on those two great radio stations. This past weekend in New York, I had dinner with Michael Berry of KPRC Radio, the operations manager there. He's a great guy, and we were really happy to be able to spend some time with Michael. We were also had dinner with Curtis Sliwa, the Guardian Angels, and Curtis is a radio personality in New York City, and some other friends of ours from KDON in Las Vegas. Dr. Wachs and Heidi Harris doing a morning show there, had a good time and a great time on our panel talking about, I forget what we were talking about. I almost got into a fist fight with that guy from WOR Radio. I don't know what his name is.
I'm going to look it up on her website.
Go find out. He's a very nice guy. When I say fist fight, there was one point where we almost started throwing hands on each other, but then I calmed down because, you know, like, what? You know, we're not going to, we're sitting up there on this panel talking about, arguing about health care. And then there's other people in radio who are arguing with us about health care. I'm going, why are we here doing our shows? What are we doing our shows here for, man? I mean, this is an industry panel. Why aren't we talking about how to do a radio show? How to make money. Money. How to make more and more and more and more and more of it. Why are we sitting here arguing our point of view about health care? Other than that, though, I had a great time. And Mike Harrison is always a great host. So I appreciate that very much, Mike. Our number is 877-876-PHIL. Speaking of screaming and yelling and arguing, I was in a screaming and yelling match with my producer, Jason Rantz, here just before we went on the air because I said, now, wait a minute. Just hold the phone. Hold on. Hold everything. There's a guy that he doesn't want to vote for this health care thing if it means there's going to be money going to aborting babies. Okay. Stupak. Now, the bill apparently doesn't have money going to aborting babies. But wait a minute, Phil. It may. Why? Because some of the subsidies that are received by poorer people so they can afford to buy health insurance. Remember, there's no public plan in this bill. There's no public plan. There's no national health care apparatus. There is simply this bill basically is the following. It's a way to discount health insurance for people, and it also mandates, requires legally that everybody have health insurance. So it's trying to, A, discount the price of insurance enough so that everyone can do what the law says they're supposed to do, and that's buy health insurance. All right, so having said all of that, if a poor person can't afford it, there are certain subsidies. There are instruments that they can, that's the word that I'm looking for.
Well, I'm still looking up WOR and who that guy is that you almost fought.
Yeah, that's great. Get out of here. I'm on to something else. And I didn't almost fight him. There are certain instruments they can avail themselves of so they can afford the insurance that they are mandated to have. Okay. Now, the thinking is this. Aha, wait a minute. If they are afforded these subsidies, if poor people are subsidized by the government, that does mean technically that if they go out and they find an insurance plan that does abort babies, then they are going to be subsidized by the government. They're going to be subsidized by taxpayers. And so, yes, it does do that. All right. So then Stupak went and he got this instrument. I call it an instrument. He got this executive order from Bush. Now, what was that thing? I'm going to explain it to you. It doesn't have the force of law. What it does have is this. It is a big ornate. It's a really cool way of patting him on the ass and saying everything's okay. I guarantee. It's basically Obama giving like some sort of a warranty. You know, this is my warranty for you, John Stupak. No baby killing dollars. Now, I sat there and I said, I know that Obama cannot change what's in the law. That executive order does not change the language of the law. It doesn't supersede the language of the law. Everybody knows that. They spent an inordinate amount of time on cable news this weekend with Fox and CNN explaining how an executive order does not change the law. And I say an inordinate amount of time because it really shows how either stupid the people are on cable news or the people that watch cable news are, that they had to have hour after hour after hour after hour devoted to telling people, now this doesn't have the force of law. Because anybody who took high school civics would know that already. But now I don't understand. And then they had the appeal. I don't understand. How is it he can say this when in point of fact? Now, here is the bill. This is as close as I don't have it in front of me, but this is as close to it as I can come. Because I was asking my producer. He said that Obama thinks that the executive order supersedes the law. And I said, no, he doesn't. He's not stupid. You can call Obama anything you want. Call him a commie. Call him big-eared. Call him every kind of racial slur. Nobody can stop you from doing that, but you can't call a man stupid. It's impossible. And it's impossible for Barack Obama to think that an executive order supersedes this piece of legislation. He doesn't believe that. And Stupak doesn't believe it either. See, folks, we can think a lot of bad things about Congress. God knows people have gone overboard in inventing new and different ways of describing how disgusting the members of Congress are to them. In fact, Congress people are so desperate to hold on to their jobs that they turn around and sell each other out. I think one of the more, to be honest with you, I think one of the more vile aspects of Congress these days is the way they sell each other out, the way they rat each other out, the way they turn on each other. I think they are that's the real lack of courage. Not the fact that they may vote a certain way that somebody doesn't agree with. It's the fact that they stumble over themselves in this obsequiously nauseating display of trying to convince the people of America that they're really on their side. Those Republicans that were standing there on that balcony with that big sign that said "Kill the Bill" were the worst of the worst. The worst, the lowest of the low. Say what you want about Pelosi, and I'm no fan of hers. No fan of hers. With that pounding of the gavel, that arrogant action of pounding that gavel, do I agree with this bill? Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Do I like her? No, I don't. Never have, and I never will. And that includes that Reid, too. But those Republicans standing there would kill the bill and don't tread on me, you phony balonies. You talk about a pack of gutless wonders. I've never seen a bigger group. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that. My whole thing is this. If you get a subsidy from the federal government to buy insurance, you may not. And I'm going to underline it again. You may not use those subsidies to purchase an insurance plan that provides for abortions. You may not. You understand? I know you understand, but I'm saying this is 99.999. I'm absolute certain this is what the health bill calls for. Now, most people don't understand that. And people will say, have you read the bill? Because I don't know anybody that's ever read the bill. I know the language that was in the original bill, because I did read that one. I know that things have changed, but they haven't changed so radically that a pro-life Democrat is going to go off of his pro-life stance and vote for this bill if he thinks for a second that people are going to be, taxpayer money is going to be used to, you know, quote unquote, kill babies. It isn't going to happen. And Obama said that it isn't going to happen. Stupak doesn't believe him. Stupak says, you're going to have to give me something in writing. That's basically what he said. Well, what do you want me to do? I want something. I want you, the President of the United States, to say it in no uncertain terms. Say it. I'm going to have this piece of paper and I'm going to wave it in front of people's faces until the day I die that Barack Obama put on a piece of paper, no money for abortions. Okay, great. Here it is. He said, he told me. How can Obama do that? He can do it by way of the following. If a poor woman gets a federal subsidy so she can go out and buy health insurance, she cannot buy a plan that provides abortions. She cannot. She can go out and get an abortion, but she can't get it by way of this plan that she bought with the federal subsidy. She may take a second job and go to a doctor's office and have an abortion performed, paying cash. Maybe she'll pick up another plan somewhere with some spare cash. I don't know if it's legal, to be honest with you. I really don't. But I suppose there are ways that she can get around it. However, the law states that none of these monies that are afforded to people who need the money based on need. And folks, here's another thing. And because it's amazing. It really is. People are saying, well, now, you know, the IRS is going to be butting into our lives now and the federal government is going to know. No, unless you call filling out a form, which is like a, you know, an application form for insurance that asks you what your income is. If you call that an intrusion into your life, well, then, this new health care legislation is going to have to get in line behind, I don't know, God knows how many other things where we regularly fill out what our annual income is and how much we can afford and how much we can't afford. So in order to qualify for these subsidies, you have to show need. So when people said, well, here is how you show need. Well, how did they attack that one? They said, aha, look at that. They're looking into people's lives. Get a freaking job or something, man. Some of these cats that were opposed to this plan with stuff like the IRS is looking up your rear end to find out whether, you know, who you are, what you are. This is another intrusion into our privacy. Get something to do besides doing this for a living because you guys are strictly from hunger, man. So you can't use the bread, right? All right. Stupak and a whole bunch of other people may not have believed that, may not have quite read it that way, may not have understood it. I don't know what his problem was. So Obama said, here is an executive order. Basically, he's saying, I swear on a stack of Bibles. I don't know what you want me to do, but I swear to God that that's what that's about. All right? He's not changing the law. He doesn't believe that he's changing the law. The idiots on cable television who tell you that Obama thinks he's changing the law, they don't know their ass from a hole in the ground. Obama's not, like I said, he's not that stupid. Now, I guarantee you, Obama may not be dumb, but 99% of these jackballs on CNN and Fox, those guys couldn't find their ass with both hands. So I can't guarantee, I can't back up their intelligence at all. They're so stupid, some of these guys, man, I can't believe they got jobs, let alone the jobs that they have. So I'm not speaking for them. I can only tell you that Obama probably gets it, and he understands that an executive order doesn't change the law. What he's doing with that executive order, putting into the hands of Stupak, is he's saying, here, I guarantee that there's no money used for abortions. I'm putting my name, President of the United States, on it. Now are you happy? And he says, yes, sir, I am. Great. Have a nice Sunday. And that's it, man. That's it. That's all it means. And having to run around and listen to some of this stuff about how, well, you know, and by the way, you realize, of course, that the president, he can't change. And I don't know how he can, when the law says, you wouldn't know what was in the law. They wouldn't know what was in the law, man, if it was spelled out in romper room numbers. All right, we're going to come back here. Captain Dale Dye is coming up. Tiger Woods gives his first interview after the crash and his sex therapy. And I was going to play a little bit of this healthcare audio, but, you know, maybe we will, maybe we won't. Our number is 877-876-PHIL. Coming up, Lloyd Bonafide, speaking as a veteran on some of these threats to Obama, and we're going to have the man who used the N-word on the steps of the Capitol to John Lewis tonight on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, 877-876-PHIL.
Phil Hendry.
Number is 877-876-PHIL to call in. Later on, we have Mr. Lloyd Bonafide, a Korean War veteran, talking about veterans and fighting for the freedom of the freedom of all citizens in this country, freedom of speech, and how he's a little disappointed in where that freedom of speech has gone. And we'll also have the man who used N-word on John Lewis this weekend, speaking of, you know, freedom of so-called speech. Also, our website is philhenryshow.com. We really encourage you to go over and take a look at our website. We have live streaming video every night. We have downloads of our show each and every day following the show, so you can listen to the show on your iPod. And we have an enormous archive of radio shows there at www.philhenryshow.com. And I am very, very proud to tell you that in just, I don't know, probably one 24-hour period, we'll be able to give you a big announcement on our website. The healthcare bill spurs assassination calls on Twitter. This is a story here. ABC had it. A whole bunch of people had it. And when it comes to Obama, assassination calls, this is old news, you know. George Bush got him. And every now and again, I think I heard one for Clinton, and Reagan got him. But Obama, it's almost like a cottage industry now of weird asses threatening to kill this man. But this is a new one. Two open calls for the assassination of Obama on Twitter, both by allegedly African-American, conservative African-American men. I don't think that there's anything all that unusual about that, but I thought I would point it out to you because some people may. And I know there's a few people who say, well, yeah, but you see, black people threaten to kill him. Now, what does that say? Oh, God, I can only imagine the brilliance infusing conversations across America when someone says, you know, someone threatened Obama's life, and did you know he was black? Oh, I didn't know that, Charlie. Oh, yeah. And the next thing you know, that's going to be a real big thing. That's significant. What's significant is this. In America, we have stupid people and crazies, and they're black and they're white. That's what we got. The more shocking piece of news is the following, that anybody would call for the life of the President of the United States openly shows a level of stupidity that breaks all records. And you're going to follow some jackball like that on Twitter? Yeah. As a matter of fact, I actually am following one of them. Solly Forrell is his name. He threatened Obama's life. He said, America, we survived the assassinations and Lincoln and Kennedy. I don't know what that means. I think he might have meant assassinations of Lincoln and Kennedy. We'll surely get over a bullet to Barack Obama's head, wrote one Twitter user who goes by the handle of Solly Forrell and identifies himself as a conservative blogger and an authentic African-American. By the way, His Twitter account is still active. I'm following him. And he's about as boring a slob as I've ever seen. Also, a guy named Jay Martin, whose Twitter account was deactivated because he had some serious stuff. You should be assassinated, Barack Obama. I live in D.C. I'd shoot him myself. Effing serious. He was all badass, man. He was a real internet thug, a real cowboy, until he realized the Secret Service wanted to talk to him. And guess what? For the record, I never said I would do harm to the president. I simply expressed my anger. Yeah, sure. And this other guy, Forrell, he came back. He said, oh, no, I didn't mean to say that. Let's all calm down. Oh, yeah, really all calm down? Well, this one guy, this Martin guy, I think is being spoken to, if not under arrest. And the other guy, Forrell, his account is still happening. So I don't know. I have no, and I try to get answers to these questions for you guys beforehand, but we don't know why. Maybe it's because it wasn't quite as aggressive as this other guy. To threaten the life of the president, seriously, to make a serious threat on the life of the president is a felony. You can be arrested for that. You can be charged with it. You can be put in jail, pending trial, put on trial, and possibly found guilty, and then remanded to a federal prison. When did that happen? Following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It became a federal offense to murder the President of the United States. Before that, it was a local offense. It was treated as a local murder. Hence, the Dallas Police Department was the primary investigative authority around the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And it didn't happen, you know, too good, as you know. So anyway, if you go out and you say, yeah, I'd like to kill Obama, you know, look, take it from me. Don't have a Twitter account. Don't have a Facebook page. You're not ready. Okay? You might want to work your way up the ladder a little bit. I don't know. start out with Etch-A-Sketch. All right, coming up, Captain Dale Dye from HBO's The Pacific. Next, world famous Phil Hendry Show.
Yeah, by the name of that guy.
Who?
The guy from O.R.
Well, after the break.
What? Phil Hendry.
After the break.
He's our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
877-876-PHIL. Later on in this evening, we have Lloyd Bonafide, the Korean War veteran. Also, he and his wife have owned that heating and plumbing company in Alhambra for quite some time. He will be talking with us about free speech from the standpoint of a veteran. We also have the guy that used the N-word on John Lewis later on these airwaves. 877-876-PHIL. And we're very happy to have back with us Captain Dale Dye. Captain Dye is he's a great man. He is the head of Warriors Incorporated, which is a group of former military personnel, if you will, who now advise our fine people in Hollywood as to how to make an action movie, a war movie, more realistic. In point of fact, Captain Dye was the primary military advisor and probably the best war movie ever made, which was Saving Private Ryan. He's also been involved with Band of Brothers from the senior military advisor standpoint. And now this new series on HBO called The Pacific, of which we've seen the first two episodes. Captain Dye is also a veteran of military veteran of Vietnam. He has a Purple Heart, Bronze Star. I guess your neck gets a little sore, Captain Dye, with all those medals hanging around it, huh? Do you have to do extra exercises or anything? Or?
Nah, I'm pretty good with that. I'm bulletproof on the left side.
There you go. Hey, Captain Dye, great to have you with us again. Always such a great pleasure, man. And the work you do in bringing to American audiences the reality of war. I recalled talking to you years ago when Saving Private Ryan came out, because I remember what my father said, who was a veteran of the Second World War. He said, nothing would make you crap your pants like the sound of a German tank. And sure enough, in that film, you had something that I'd never seen before in a movie, the actual grinding of the gears of those panzers as those soldiers were waiting in their foxholes for the enemy to approach. It was a nerve-wracking
move.
Yeah, you did. And now we have the Pacific. You were involved in Band of Brothers. I don't know where to begin with this series, Dale. I guess the first thing I want to ask you, based upon a lot of the conversations we've had, did you go out and do what you did, like for Private Ryan and Band of Brothers? Did you look up all that equipment, man? Did you try to find the authentic stuff? What kind of prep did you do on this in terms of the equipment?
This was years in prep, Phil, because so much of the stuff just doesn't exist. I mean, those little, for instance, those little Type 95 Japanese tankettes, they look like little Tinker Toys. You probably have seen pictures of them on the History Channel and things like that. We could just find a few old, rusted, rotted pieces of the undercarriage, and we had to kind of reverse engineer and build them from there and then make them run. So, I mean, we went through extraordinary lengths to get these little details right.
The uniforms. I noticed from documentary footage the Marines in the Pacific had those baggy pants, but at the beginning of the series, we see them with their leggings. Was this something that the Marines just gradually lost as the fatigue and the reality of combat sort of took its toll?
Well, the dungaree uniform that it was called, it was made out of herringbone twill material designed to be very tough and so on and so forth. But it was it was designed to fit you like regular trousers and shirt and so on and so forth. But they got to the point in the Pacific where they were skin and bones. And that provided that sort of baggy look. Now the leggings were something that Marines have worn for years and years and years, and wore them all the way up through the Korean War. What happened was during the landings, in the amphibious landings across beaches and things like that, they quickly found out that those things just filled up with sand.
So they kind of
took them off, or they rolled their trousers up, and nobody was holding uniform inspections back then, so they got fairly ratty.
Understood. Yeah, I think it's a very classic I guess you almost say it's archetypal for us to see those Marines with those baggy pants as they advanced from island to island. Working with the actors on the Pacific, Dale, tell me about, did you run the boot camp, man, like you do for all those other, you know, all those other pretty boys?
Oh, yeah. This one was particularly intense. I had a dog in the hunt here, Phil, because the 1st Marine Division's my outfit.
Okay.
So I wanted it right, and I put the pressure on hard and heavy. We did the training up north in the northern part of Australia, far north Queensland, up in the high rainforest up there. And at the same time, we were training these 50 actors, performers to be Marines. We were also training 30 Japanese troops. I had members
of my
staff who are Imperial Japanese Army experts. And they trained those guys under the, you know, the kind of code of Bushido, all in Japanese.
Wow.
They ate rice and fish heads and the whole number. And then the idea was, is as we progressed through training, after about 4 or 5 days, we began to bump these two units into each other up in the jungle. So it was an impressive effort.
When you say bump into each other, you're not shooting at each other, but
I do.
What?
That's exactly
Oh, really? Okay.
But
tell me about that, brother.
Blank ammunition, obviously. But
okay.
You know, at that point, it wouldn't have made any difference what it was because they're living in the moment. I mean, I've got them so isolated, and living in the 1940s at that point, you know, all they were really worried about is can I survive the next 5 minutes. So we bumped into them hard. They had their Nambu machine guns set up in hard points, and we had to set our machine guns up and lay down a base of fire and have the infantry maneuver onto them. And you know, the only thing that kept them from sticking bayonets into each other was I had my guys finally pull back when they got within that range.
No kidding. Yeah.
That was, it was intense.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll bet, man. Because, I don't know that people appreciate really the just this level of expertise. So when we look at a film like Saving Private Ryan, we look at Band of Brothers, I don't think people appreciate those films. That TV series is so touches us so deeply, so authentic because of that real military touch that you bring to it, Dale. I wanted to ask you about the Japanese soldier you just mentioned. Was this the same core of actors throughout? Did they change? In other words, are we looking at the same guy that got shot 100 times?
Because it's Phil Hendry, I'm going to tell you the truth.
Okay.
Throughout the series, you're going to see 40 Japanese guys. They're all the same 40 in every episode.
The same guys getting slaughtered.
Yeah, you know, and avoid close-ups and so on and
sure.
so forth. But yeah they're the same guys.
I understand.
You killed them a couple of times.
You killed them a lot of times. To that end, Dale, I think it was in either this. I think it might have been the second episode, maybe the first. Following that initial battle there at the creek, I forget the name. Alligator Creek, was it?
Yeah.
In Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
A Japanese soldier is seen the next morning alive and obviously angry that he's not dead.
Yep.
He's wanting to give himself up to the emperor and ride on the dragon. He's running back and forth, and the Marines are seen torturing him, basically, taking shots, winging him here and winging him there, until one lifts up his pistol and applies it to the coup de grace. Is this based on a real event?
Yep, it is indeed.
It is.
And it's interesting you notice that, because that's precisely what was going on. And this comes from a story we were told by a guy from the 1st Marine Regiment who fought at Alligator Creek. And he said that they had a survivor, and the guy just was nuts. He was out of his skull, and he walked out into the middle of Alligator Creek, and he was screaming invective in Japanese. And a couple of the Marines just started pot-shooting at him with their O3 Springfields. And eventually, they hit him 3 or 4 times. He wouldn't go down. Finally, one of them got tired of it and drew his 1911 45 and nailed him and dropped him. But the idea was there to show, you know, how that sort of war and that sort of deprivation and that sort of thing will kind of take the, you know, it'll take the ethics out of you. It'll take the heart out of you. And
well, I was going to say, Dale, one of the things that you show leading up to that, though, is you show the bodies of American Marines that had been disemboweled. They'd had their heads removed. They'd had things stuck in their mouths. So the Marines saw other American soldiers that had their bodies desecrated. Didn't this feed into a feeling of vengeance on the part of some of these soldiers?
Yeah, Yeah, it really did. And it's amazing. Yeah. That's exactly what happened. I mean, it was no holds barred, no quarter very quickly after the 7 August 1942 counteroffensive on Guadalcanal. I mean, they quickly learned that they were up against an enemy that just didn't play games. I mean, they didn't do it in the standard European mode of you know, combat according to the rules of Hoyle. They knew they were up against a really serious deal. And one of the interesting things I found is we, you know, for Band of Brothers, we talk to a lot of these old gents in their 80s now. And they're kind of, well, okay, it was really tough, but we're over it now. But you talk to the guys who fought in the Pacific, and they're still pissed. They're still upset.
I'll bet.
You know, and we kind of wanted to convey why that was. I mean, it was a clash of cultures.
Yeah.
We didn't understand them, and that we didn't get the why they fought that way. And we quickly found out that the only way to handle it was to fight the way they fought.
Yeah. We have Captain Dale Dye with us. A half hour is not long enough, but we'll go to the end of the half hour talking to Captain Dye about his work on the HBO series The Pacific, which is, I guess you could say, a companion piece or the bookend to Band of Brothers, which was the story of the 101st Airborne, one of the companies of the 101st Airborne in Europe. And Dale, forgive me, you know, because maybe I came in too late or something here, man, but is the Pacific based on one particular? I know it's the first Marines, but any smaller component of that being followed here? Is there a specific story being told?
That was the problem, Phil. When we did Band of Brothers, we only had to deal with one company, Easy Company, or Company E, 2nd Battalion, 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division.
Right.
With the Pacific, we're dealing with, and that you know, Easy Company probably never was more than 120 people. With the Pacific, we're dealing with an entire division, the 1st Marine Division, right from down south of us at Camp Pendleton. And that was 22,000 men. And our three lead characters all come from the three regiments of that division, the 1st Marines, the 5th Marines, and the 7th Marines. So the problem was having to weave our story and interconnect all of the characters. So that's the difficulty. We're dealing with four or five guys that we get to know in the 1st Marines, four or five guys that we get to know in the 5th Marines, and four or five guys that we get to know in the 7th Marines. And we're constantly weaving in and out of those three regiments of the overall 1st Marine Division. It's a tough storytelling chore.
It is. I noticed, and I see them just sort of trying to deftly do that as one division. Like in the last episode, the guys are moving in as the other guys are shaving and trying to clean up and licking their wounds. And also, William Sadler, we need to point out, plays the famous 1st Marine General. Forgive me, I forget his name.
Dusty Puller.
There you go.
Lewis Burwell.
How was William Sadler in the boot camp?
He was fine. I mean, he was there, and he was doing his best to kind of clone me, you know, channel the Captain Dye character and seeing if he could come up with Dusty Puller. But he had a tough time, Phil. I mean, and probably John Seda, who plays Manila John Bassalone. I mean, these are two iconic characters in the Marine Corps. I mean, Marine recruits to this day, you know, still when they jump in the rack at night, still all sound off, "Good night, Chesty, wherever you are." I mean, he's that kind of an icon. And here you had Bill Sadler and John Seda trying to be Manila John Bassalone. These guys had a really, really tough time. They had to find a hook to that character and do what they could with it.
Well, I love that scene where he says that, and then we're going to take a break. I love the scene where William Sadler, playing General Fuller, says, "We have been told that if we lose the airfield, we will pull back to the jungle and we will fight as a guerrilla band. Gentlemen, this isn't going to happen."
Yeah.
And you hear them all say, "Aye, aye, sir." That was outstanding. That was outstanding.
That's Jesse Fuller.
Dale Dye is with us. We're going to be back, talk more about the Pacific, a series on HBO that Dale had a huge part of. He was a senior military advisor on that series, and we're going to talk more with Captain Dye when we come back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Bill Hendry.
Here, world famous Phil Hendry show later on tonight. We've got with us Lloyd Bonafide and the man who used the N-word on John Lewis, allegedly. With us is Captain Dale Dye. Captain Dye, the military advisor on the Pacific. Captain Dye, a Marine Corps veteran himself, a Marine, and this is about the U.S. Marines in the Pacific. The Pacific being the story of our battle against the Japanese. Captain Dye, I wanted to ask you about the Guadalcanal. We're seeing two episodes on Guadalcanal. Do you guys get into much more of it? Because I know that Mitchell Page is a very famous Marine who won the Medal of Honor there on the 26th of October.
Right.
Holding off an entire company of Japanese. I don't know if you guys cover that or not.
No, we don't. We didn't get into Mitchell Page. It kind of diffused okay. the Vassalon story, Phil.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, and, because that's the key. That character's the key. Yeah.
Yeah, he's the one we focused on. I mean, not to say that Mitch Page wasn't just as heroic. He was. But, you know, there was so much that went on, we had to find three characters and kind of stay with them. So.
Absolutely. And to that end, you guys should watch for, in the opening episodes, this sort of wave assault that the Japanese would embark upon and the machine gun fire of the Marines cutting them down. Those veterans that you hear from in the episode say, the way they fought, the way the Japanese fought, made it like a turkey shoot.
Yeah, it was to some extent. The minute the Japanese committed to an attack, they went all out, balls to the wall. I mean, it was banzai and go.
Mm-hmm.
They got slippery and tricky and more comfortable, harder to fight when they were in intense jungle. But when we were in defensive positions, like we were around Henderson Field on Guadalcanal. They would move up as close as they could get. They would mass, and then they would come at you.
Dale, having done a little bit of TV and movie work myself, I know that you guys are going to do 12-hour shoots, sometimes 15-hour days. So it's not hard to imagine, you know, that you guys are on set, say, at 6 a.m. You don't get off set till 1 a.m. I bet you the actors are every bit as tired and grubby and feeling rotten as their characters call for. But some of these guys, of course, they knock off, they get a 12-hour, and then they're back on the set. But I guess there's no sleep for the weary, man. You are there all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, we were 13 months in Australia on this. Me and I had a staff of 13 of my guys from Warriors, and 16, 18-hour days were nothing.
Like 18 hours a day? Oh,
yeah,
my God, man.
Yeah.
Dale, tell me again where you guys shot this, in Australia?
Everything was shot in Australia, Phil, but we started with the beach landings and the heavy jungle stuff in far north Queensland, Australia, all the way up at the north end of the continent. And then when we got into the Peleliu episodes, Cape Gloucester, things like that, we moved down toward Melbourne. We were in an Australian national park called the Yuyangs, believe it or not. I always thought it was yin yang, and after I was there a couple of months, that was exactly what I thought of it. But it was
yin yang.
Yeah, it was about a half an hour to 45 minutes northwest of Melbourne, and we commuted every day, and that added hours to our work day. But you know, like I said, we really, really wanted to get this one right, so it was kind of a labor of love for all the guys.
I'll bet, man. And to that end, Dale, I've always wanted to ask you this, man: how many arguments do you have with directors and producers? How many times do you say to a guy, "Wait, hold on, that ain't how it happens. That's not the way it happens. You're going to make this look like a joke." I mean, did you have much of that on this?
You mean how many per day or how many per hour?
Got to go to the wall with these guys, huh?
Well, the thing is, my reputation kind of precedes me, if not exceeds me, I think. And and we were kind of the continuity between these hot and cold running directors, and we had some there who had worked on Band of Brothers, so they kind of knew what to do, and they knew that we were there to help, not to hinder. And so, you know, they'd get ready to set up a scene, and for the most part, I would set it up and run it. And then they'd say, okay, we'll fix this or fix that, or we got to do this or we got to do that. And so it certainly wasn't, you know, kumbaya and join hands and dance around the maypole. On the other hand, we got along pretty well with each other.
That's good, man. I only got 30 seconds, Dale. Were Hanks and Spielberg, did they come in and screw things up much, or were you able to keep them away from you?
No, they screwed us up long distance. For the most part, I mean, you know, they gave us these marching orders. You know, they said, we want it right, we want it impactful, we want it to tell the real story. You guys know how to do it. Get out there and get it done.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, every time, everything you touch, man, you get it done. It's fantastic, Dale.
I hope so.
Thanks for talking to us. Hey, man, I'm looking forward to the third installment, The Pacific. Dale Dye's been with us, the senior military advisor on The Pacific, on Band of Brothers, Saving Private Ryan. Thanks a lot, Captain Dye. Have a good one, man.
Thanks, Phil. Always good to talk to you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Captain Dale Dye. We'll be back here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show with Lloyd Bonafide and the man who used the N-word on John Lewis. It's The Phil Hendry Show.
Phil Hendry.